Welcome to Stories After Midnight. Today we're going to be reading My Father Locked Us in a Fallout Shelter. We May Never Be Able to Leave by Society's Menace CC from Reddit. I hope you enjoy this story. If you do, let me know in the comments below. A huge shout out to my patrons for helping make this episode possible. Let's get started. My name is Michael, and this is the story of how my father stole our childhood and trapped us in a nightmare that lasted for years. It all started when I was 10 years old. My sister Sarah was 8 at the time. We were a normal, happy family living in a quiet suburban neighborhood in Ohio. Mom worked as a nurse at the local hospital, and Dad was an engineer for a defense contractor. Looking back, I realize now that his job was probably what planted the seeds of paranoia in his mind. Everything changed the day Mom died. It was sudden, a car accident on her way home from a night shift. Dad was devastated. We all were. But while Sarah and I grieved openly, Dad retreated into himself. He started spending more and more time in the basement, emerging only for meals or to go to work. Then, when he was around us, he was distracted, always muttering to himself and scribbling in a notebook he carried everywhere. About a month after Mom's funeral, Dad sat us down for a family meeting. His eyes had a wild, feverish gleam that I'd never seen before. "Kids," he said, his voice trembling with barely contained excitement. "I've been working on something important, something that's going to keep us safe." Sarah and I exchanged confused glances. "Safe from what?" Dad continued. "The world is a dangerous place. There are threats out there that most people can't even imagine. But I've seen the signs. I know it's coming." He went on to explain in terrifying detail about the impending nuclear war that he was certain was just around the corner. He talked about radiation, fallout, and the collapse of society. As he spoke, his words became more and more frantic, and I felt a cold dread settling in the pit of my stomach. "But don't worry," he said, his face breaking into an unsettling grin. "Daddy's going to protect you. I've built us a shelter. We'll be safe there when the bombs fall." That night, he showed us the shelter he'd constructed in secret. The basement had been completely transformed. What was once a cluttered storage space was now a fortified bunker. The walls were lined with thick concrete, and a heavy, vault-like door had been installed at the entrance. Inside the shelter was stocked with canned food, water barrels, medical supplies, and all manner of survival gear. Dad was so proud as he gave us the tour, pointing out all the features he'd incorporated to keep us safe. But all I felt was a growing sense of unease. This wasn't normal. This wasn't right. For the next few weeks, life continued somewhat normally. Dad still went to work, and Sarah and I still went to school. But every evening, he'd take us down to the shelter for drills. We'd practice sealing the door, putting on gas masks, and rationing food. He quizzed us relentlessly on radiation safety procedures and what to do in various emergency scenarios. Then came the night that changed everything. I was jolted awake by the blaring of air raid sirens. Disoriented and terrified, I stumbled out of bed to find Dad already in my room, roughly shaking me awake. "It's happening!" he shouted over the noise. "We need to get to the shelter, now!" He dragged me down the hallway, where we met Sarah, tears streaming down her face as she clutched her favorite stuffed animal. Dad herded us down the stairs and into the basement. The shelter door stood open, bathed in the eerie red glow of emergency lighting.
"Quickly, inside," Dad urged, pushing us through the doorway. "We don't have much time."
As soon as we were in, Dad slammed the door shut behind us. The heavy locks engaged with a series of metallic clanks that sounded like a death knell to my young ears. The sirens were muffled now, but still audible through the thick walls.
"It's okay," Dad said, gathering us into a tight hug. "We're safe now. Everything's going to be all right."
But it wasn't all right. Nothing would ever be all right again. Hours passed, and the sirens eventually fell silent. We waited, huddled together on one of the cramped bunk beds Dad had installed. He kept checking his watch and a Geiger counter he'd mounted on the wall, muttering about radiation levels and fallout patterns. Days turned into weeks, and still Dad refused to let us leave the shelter. He said it wasn't safe, that the radiation outside would kill us in minutes.
Sarah and I begged to go outside to see what had happened, to find our friends and neighbors, but Dad was adamant. "There's nothing left out there," he'd say, his eyes wild and unfocused. "Everyone's gone. We're the lucky ones. We survived." At first, we believed him. We were young and scared, and he was our father. Why would he lie to us? But as time wore on, doubts began to creep in. The shelter's small TV and radio picked up nothing but static, which Dad said was due to the EMP from the nuclear blasts. But sometimes, late at night when he thought we were asleep, I'd catch him fiddling with the dials, a look of frustrated confusion on his face. We fell into a monotonous routine. Dad homeschooled us using old textbooks he'd stockpiled. We exercised in the small space to stay healthy. We rationed our food carefully, with Dad always reminding us that we might need to stay in the shelter for years. The worst part was the isolation. The shelter felt more like a prison with each passing day. The recycled air was stale and oppressive. The artificial lighting gave me constant headaches. And the silence, the awful, suffocating silence, was broken only by the hum of air filtration systems and our own voices. Sarah took it the hardest. She was only 8 when we entered the shelter, and as the months dragged on, I watched the light in her eyes slowly dim. She stopped playing with her toys, stopped laughing at my jokes. She'd spend hours just staring at the blank concrete walls, lost in her own world. I tried to stay strong for her, but it was hard. I missed the sun, the wind, the feeling of grass beneath my feet. I missed my friends, my school, the life we'd left behind. But every time I brought up the possibility of leaving, Dad would fly into a rage. "You want to die?" he'd scream, spittle flying from his lips. "You want the radiation to melt your insides? To watch your skin fall off in chunks? Is that what you want?" His anger was terrifying, and so we learned to stop asking. We became quiet, obedient shadows of our former selves, going through the motions of our underground existence. As our time in the shelter stretched from months into years, I began to notice changes in Dad. His paranoia, already intense, seemed to worsen. He'd spend hours poring over his notebooks, muttering about conspiracy theories and hidden threats. Sometimes I'd wake in the night to find him standing over our beds, just watching us sleep with an unreadable expression on his face. He became obsessed with conserving our resources, implementing stricter and stricter rationing. Our meals shrank to meager portions that left us constantly hungry. He said it was necessary, that we needed to prepare for the possibility of staying in the shelter for decades. But there were inconsistencies that I couldn't ignore. Sometimes I'd notice that the labels on our canned goods were newer than they should have been, given how long we'd supposedly been in the shelter. And once, I could have sworn I heard distant traffic noises while Dad was in the shower, sounds that should have been impossible if the world above had been destroyed. Slowly, a terrible suspicion began to form in my mind. What if there had never been a nuclear war? What if Dad had made it all up? The thought was almost too horrible to contemplate, but once it took root, I couldn't shake it. I began to watch Dad more closely, looking for any slip-ups or sign that might confirm my suspicions. And then one night, I saw something that changed everything. It was late, well past the time when Sarah and I were supposed to be asleep. I'd woken up thirsty and was about to get some water when I heard the unmistakable sound of the shelter door opening. Peering around the corner, I saw Dad slipping out into the basement beyond, a duffel bag slung over his shoulder. My heart pounding, I crept after him. I reached the shelter door, just as it was swinging closed, and managed to wedge my foot in to keep it from sealing shut. Through the crack, I could see Dad climbing the basement stairs. For a moment, I stood frozen, unsure of what to do. Then, gathering all my courage, I eased the door open and followed him. The basement was dark and musty, filled with shadows that seemed to reach for me with grasping fingers. I'd almost forgotten what it looked like after years in the shelter. Carefully, I made my way up the stairs, my heart thundering so loudly I was sure I could hear it. At the top of the stairs, I hesitated. The door to the main house was slightly ajar, and through it, I could hear muffled sounds, normal, everyday sounds that shouldn't exist in a post-apocalyptic world. The hum of a refrigerator, the distant bark of a dog, the soft whisper of wind through trees. Trembling, I pushed the door open and stepped into the kitchen of my childhood home. Moonlight, streamed through the windows, illuminating a scene that was both achingly familiar and utterly shocking. Everything was normal. Clean dishes in the rack by the sink. A calendar on the wall showing the current year, years after we'd entered the shelter. A bowl of fresh fruit on the counter. The world hadn't ended. It had gone on without us, oblivious to our underground prison. I heard the front door open and close, and panic seized me. Dad would be back any moment. And as quietly as I could, I raced back down to the basement and into the shelter, pulling the door shut behind me just as I heard his footsteps on the stairs above. I dove into my bunk, my mind reeling from what I'd discovered. The truth was somehow worse than any nuclear apocalypse could have been. Our own father had been lying to us for years, keeping us trapped in this underground hell for reasons I couldn't begin to understand. As I lay there in the dark, listening to Dad re-enter the shelter, I knew that everything had changed. The truth was out there just beyond that steel door, and somehow, some way, I was going to find a way to get Sierra and myself back to it. But little did I know, my midnight discovery was just the beginning. The real horrors in the fight for our freedom were yet to come. Sleep evaded me that night. I lay awake, my mind racing with the implications of what I'd seen. The world above was alive, thriving, completely oblivious to our subterranean nightmare. Every creak and groan of the shelter now seemed to mock me, a constant reminder of the lie we'd been living. As the artificial dawn broke in our windowless prison, I watched Dad go through his usual morning routine. He checked the non-existent radiation levels, inspected our dwindling supplies, and prepared our meager breakfast rations. All of it a carefully orchestrated performance, I now realized. But for what purpose? What could drive a man to lock away his own children and deceive them so completely? I struggled to act normally, terrified that Dad would somehow sense the change in me. Sarah, sweet, innocent Sarah, remained blissfully unaware. I caught her eyeing the bland, reconstituted eggs on her plate, with poorly concealed disgust, and my heart ached. How much of her childhood had been stolen? How much of mine?
"Michael?" Dad's gruff voice snapped me out of my reverie. "You're awfully quiet this morning. Everything okay, son?"
I forced a smile, hoping it didn't look as sickly as it felt. "Yes, sir. Just tired, I guess." He studied me for a moment, his eyes narrowing slightly. Had I imagined the flicker of suspicion that crossed his face?
"Well, buckle up. We've got a lot to do today. I want to run a full systems check on the air filtration units."
The day dragged on, each minute an eternity. I ran through the motions of our daily routine, all the while my mind working furiously to process everything I knew and plan our escape. But the harsh reality of our situation soon became clear. Dad held all the cards. He controlled the food, the water, the very air we breathed, and most crucially, he controlled the door. That night, after Dad had gone to sleep, I carefully shook Sarah awake, her eyes still heavy with sleep, widened in confusion as I pressed a finger to my lips, signaling for silence. Quietly, I led her to the far corner of the shelter, as far from Dad's bunk as possible.
"Sarah," I whispered, my heart pounding, "I need to tell you something important, but you have to promise to stay calm and quiet, okay?"
She nodded, fear and curiosity warring in her expression. Taking a deep breath, I told her everything, about sneaking out of the shelter, about the untouched world I'd seen above. With each word, I watched the color drain from her face.
But that's impossible," she stammered, her voice barely audible. "Dad said the radiation."
"I know what Dad said," I cut her off gently. "But he lied to us, Sarah. I don't know why, but he's been lying this whole time."
Tears welled up in her eyes, and I pulled her into a tight hug.
"What are we going to do?"
she sobbed into my shoulder.
"We're going to get out of here," I promised, trying to sound more confident than I felt. "I don't know how yet, but we will. We just need to be patient and wait for the right moment."
Little did I know how long that wait would be, or how high the cost of our freedom would climb. The next few weeks were a special kind of torture. Every moment felt like walking on a knife's edge. We went about our daily routines, pretending everything was normal, all while watching Dad for any opportunity to escape. But he was vigilant, almost obsessively so. The shelter door remained firmly locked, the key always on a chain around his neck. Sarah struggled to maintain the pretense. I'd often catch her staring longingly at the door or flinching away from Dad's touch. More than once, I had to distract him when her eyes welled up with tears for no apparent reason. As for me, I threw myself into learning everything I could about the shelter's systems. I volunteered to help Dad with maintenance tasks, memorizing every pipe, wire, and vent. Knowledge, I reasoned, would be our best weapon when the time came to act. It was during one of these maintenance sessions that I made a chilling discovery. We were checking the integrity of the shelter's outer walls when I noticed something odd. A small section that sounded hollow when tapped. Dad quickly ushered me away, claiming it was just a quirk of the construction, but I knew better. That night, while the others slept, I carefully examined the wall. It took hours of painstaking searching, but eventually I found it. A hidden panel, cunningly disguised. My hands shaking, I managed to pry it open. What I found inside made my blood run cold. Stacks of newspapers, their dates spanning the years we'd been underground. Printed emails from Dad's work asking about his extended family emergency leave. And most damning of all, a small journal filled with Dad's frantic scribblings. I didn't have time to read it all, but what I did see painted a picture of a man spiraling into paranoid delusion. Dad wrote about protecting us from a world he saw as irredeemably corrupt and dangerous. He convinced himself that keeping us in the shelter was the only way to ensure our safety and purity. As I carefully replaced everything and sealed the panel, a new fear gripped me. We weren't just dealing with a liar or a kidnapper. We were trapped underground with a madman. And the next morning, Dad announced a new addition to our daily routine, decontamination showers. He claimed it was an extra precaution against radiation, but the gleam in his eyes told a different story. He was tightening his control, adding another layer to his elaborate fantasy. The showers were cold and uncomfortable, but it was the violation of privacy that hurt the most. Dad insisted on supervising to ensure we were thorough. I saw the way his gaze lingered on Sarah, and something dark and angry unfurled in my chest. We had to get out, and soon. Opportunity came in the form of a malfunction in the water filtration system. Dad was forced to go to his hidden cache of supplies for replacement parts. It was a risk, but it might be our only chance.
Sarah!
I whispered urgently, as soon as Dad had left the main room.
Remember what I taught you about the door mechanism?
She nodded, her face pale but determined.
Good. When I give the signal, I need you to run to the control panel and enter the emergency unlock code. Can you do that?
Another nod.
Okay. I'm going to create a distraction. No matter what happens, no matter what you hear, don't stop until that door is open. Promise me.
I promise, she whispered back. Her voice steady, despite the fear in her eyes. Taking a deep breath, I steeled myself for what I had to do. I'd never deliberately hurt anyone before, let alone my own father. But as I thought of Sarah's haunted eyes, of the years stolen from us, I knew I had no choice. I waited until I heard Dad's footsteps approaching. Then I put our plan into action. I yanked hard on one of the water pipes I'd secretly loosened earlier, letting out a yell of surprise as it burst, spraying water everywhere. Dad came running, and in the chaos that followed, I made my move. As he bent to examine the broken pipe, I brought the wrench heavy down on the back of his head. He crumpled to the floor, a look of shocked betrayal on his face as he lost consciousness. Fighting back the wave of nausea and guilt, I shouted to Sarah,
"Now! Do it now!"
She sprang into action, her small fingers flying over the control panel. I heard the blessed sound of locks disengaging, and then the door was swinging open.
Come on!
I grabbed Sarah's hand and we ran, our bare feet slapping against the cold concrete on the basement floor. Up the stairs, through the kitchen that still looked so surreal in its normalcy, and finally out the front door. The outside world hit us like a physical blow. The sun, so much brighter than we remembered, seared our eyes. The wind, carrying a thousand scents we'd almost forgotten, nearly knocked us off our feet. For a moment, we stood frozen on the front porch, overwhelmed by sensations we'd been deprived of for so long. Then we heard it, a groan from inside the house. Dad was waking up. Panic lent us speed. Hand in hand, we ran down the street, ignoring the shocked stares of neighbors we no longer recognized. We ran until our lungs burned and our legs threatened to give out, the sounds of pursuit real or imagined spurring us on. Finally, we collapsed in a park several blocks away, gasping for breath. As the adrenaline faded, the reality of our situation began to sink in. We were free, yes, but we were also alone, confused, and terribly vulnerable in a world that had moved on without us. Sarah burst into tears, the events of the day finally overwhelming her. I held her close, my own eyes stinging as I whispered soothing nonsense and stroked her hair. "It's okay," I told her, trying to convince myself as much as her. "We're out. We're safe now." But even as the words left my mouth, I knew they weren't true. Dad was still out there, and I had no doubt he would come looking for us. And beyond that, how are we supposed to integrate back into a society we barely remembered? How could we explain where we'd been, what had happened to us? As the sun began to set on our first day of freedom, I realized with a sinking heart that our ordeal was far from over. In many ways, it was just beginning. The world we emerged into was nothing like the post-apocalyptic wasteland our father had described. There were no piles of rubble, no radiation-scorched earth, no roaming bands of desperate survivors. Instead, we found ourselves in a typical suburban neighborhood, unchanged except for the passage of time. Houses stood intact, their windows gleaming in the fading sunlight. Neatly trimmed lawns stretching up before us, the scent of freshly cut grass almost overwhelming after years of recycled air. In the distance, we could hear the familiar sounds of modern life. Cars humming along roads, the faint chatter of a television from an open window, a dog barking at some unseen disturbance. It was jarringly, terrifyingly normal. As we stumbled through this alien familiar landscape, the full weight of our father's deception crashed down upon us. There had been no nuclear war, no worldwide catastrophe, no reason for us to have been locked away all these years. The realization was almost too much to bear. Sarah's grip on my hand tightened. "Michael," she whispered, her voice trembling, "why would Dad lie to us like that?" I had no answer for her. The enormity of what had been done to us was beyond my comprehension. How could a father willingly imprison his own children, robbing them of years of their lives? The man I thought I knew seemed to crumble away, leaving behind a stranger whose motives I couldn't begin to fathom. We made our way through the neighborhood, flinching at every car that passed, every person we saw in the distance. To them, we must have looked like wild creatures, barefoot, wide-eyed, dressed in the simple, utilitarian clothes we'd worn in the shelter. More than once, I caught sight of curtains twitching as curious neighbors peered out at us. As night fell, the temperature dropped, and I realized we needed to find shelter. The irony of the thought wasn't lost on me. After years of being trapped underground, we were now desperately seeking a roof over our heads. "I think I know where we can go," I told Sarah, the ghost of a memory tugging at me. "Do you remember Mrs. Callahan, Mom's friend from the hospital?" Sarah's brow furrowed as she tried to recall. "The nice lady with the cats?" "That's right," I said, relieved that at least some of our memories from before remained intact. "She lived a few blocks from us, if she's still there." It was a long shot, but it was all we had. We made our way through the darkening streets, every shadow seeming to hide a threat. More than once I was sure I heard footsteps behind us, only to turn and find nothing there. Finally, we reached a small, well-kept house with a porch light glowing warmly. The nameplate by the door read Callahan, and I felt a surge of hope. Taking a deep breath, I rang the doorbell. Long moments passed. I was about to ring again when the door creaked open, revealing a woman in her 60s, her gray hair pulled back into a loose bun. Her eyes widened in shock as she took in our appearance.
"My God," she breathed. "Michael? Sarah, is that really you?"
Before I could respond, she had pulled us into the house and enveloped us in a fierce hug. The familiar scent of her perfume, the same one she'd worn years ago, brought tears to my eyes.
"We thought you were dead,"
Mrs. Callahan said, her voice choked with emotion.
"Your father said there had been an accident, that you'd all died."
As she ushered us into her living room, plying us with blankets and promises of hot cocoa, the full extent of our father's lies began to unravel. There had been no accident. No tragedy to explain our disappearance, just a man's descent into madness, and the two children he'd dragged down with him. Mrs. Callahan listened in horror as we recounted our years in the shelter. Her face paled when we described the decontamination showers and the increasingly erratic behavior of our father.
"We have to call the police," she said, reaching for her phone. "That man needs to be locked up for what he's done to you."
But even as she dialed, a cold dread settled in my stomach. Something wasn't right. The feeling of being watched that had plagued me since our escape intensified. And then, with a jolt of terror, I realized what had been nagging at me. The house was too quiet. Where were Mrs. Callahan's cats? As if in answer to my unspoken question, a floorboard creaked behind us. We whirled around to see a figure standing in the doorway, backlit by the hallway light. My heart stopped as I recognized the familiar silhouette.
"Dad,"
Sarah whimpered, shrinking back against me. He stepped into the room, and I saw that he was holding something, the length of pipe I'd used to strike him during our escape. His eyes, when they met mine, were cold and empty. "I'm very disappointed in you, Michael," he said, his voice eerily calm. "I thought I'd raised you better than this. Didn't I teach you about the dangers of the outside world?" Mrs. Callahan moved to stand in front of us, her phone clutched in her hand.
"John, what have you done? These children..."
"Are my children," Dad snarled, all pretense of calm evaporating. "And I'll do whatever it takes to protect them, even from themselves." He advanced into the room, the pipe raised threateningly. Mrs. Callahan stood her ground, but I could see her trembling.
"Run,"
she hissed at us.
"Oh, hold them off. Run."
Everything happened so fast after that. Dad lunged forward. There was a sickening thud and Mrs. Callahan crumpled to the floor. Sarah screamed. Then we were running again, out the back door and into the night. Behind us, I could hear Dad's heavy footsteps and his voice, once so comforting, now twisted with madness.
"Children, come back. It's not safe out there."
But we knew the truth now. The only thing not safe was the man we'd once called father. As we fled into the darkness, weaving between houses and jumping fences, a new determination filled me. We were out now. We knew the truth, and no matter what it took, I was going to make sure we stayed free. But freedom, I was quickly learning, came with its own set of challenges, and the night was far from over. The next few hours were a blur of fear and adrenaline. Sarah and I ran until our lungs burned and our legs felt like they were going to give out at any moment. Every sound made us jump. Every shadow seemed to hide our father's lurking form. But somehow we managed to evade him. As dawn broke, we found ourselves in a small park on the outskirts of town. Exhausted and with nowhere else to go, we huddled together on a bench, watching the world wake up around us. People jogged past, dogs barked in the distance, and the smell of fresh coffee wafted from a nearby cafe. It was all so beautifully, painfully normal.
"What do we do now?"
Sarah asked, her voice small and scared. Before I could answer, a police car pulled up beside the park. Two officers got out, their eyes scanning the area before landing on us. My heart raced, but I forced myself to stay calm. This was what we needed, help from the authorities. As the officers approached, I saw recognition dawn in their eyes. They'd been looking for us. What followed was a whirlwind of activity. We were taken to the police station where gentle-voiced detectives asked us questions about our time in the shelter. Social workers were called, and all the while the search for our father intensified. They found him 3 days later, holed up in an abandoned building on the edge of town. It didn't go quietly. In the end, it took a team of negotiators and a SWAT unit to bring him in. The man they arrested bore little resemblance to the father we once knew, wild-eyed and ranting about protecting his children from the corrupted world. He seemed more monster than man. The trial was a media sensation. Our story captivated the nation, sparking debates about mental health, parental rights, and the long-term effects of isolation. Experts were brought in to explain our father's descent into paranoid delusion. Some painted him as a victim of his own mind, while others condemned him as a monster. For Sarah and me, it was a painful process of reliving our trauma in the public eye, but it was also cathartic. Each testimony, each piece of evidence presented, helped to dismantle the false reality our father had constructed around us. In the end, he was found guilty on multiple charges and sentenced to life in prison. As they led him away, he looked at us one last time. "I only wanted to keep you safe," he said, his voice breaking. It was the last time we ever saw him. The years that followed were challenging. Sarah and I had a lot to catch up on. Years of education, social development, and life experiences that had been stolen from us. We underwent intensive therapy, learning to process our trauma and adjust to life in the real world. It wasn't easy. There were nightmares, panic attacks, and moments when the outside world felt too big, too overwhelming. Simple things that others took for granted, like going to a crowded mall or watching fireworks on the 4th of July, could trigger intense anxiety for us. But slowly, painfully, we began to heal. We learned to trust again, to form relationships with others. We discovered the joys of simple freedoms, the feeling of rain on our skin, the taste of fresh fruit, the simple pleasures of choosing what to wear each day. Sarah threw herself into her studies, making up for lost time with a voracious appetite for knowledge. She's in college now, studying psychology with a focus on trauma and recovery. She wants to help others who have gone through similar experiences. As for me, I found solace in writing. Putting our story down on paper was terrifying at first, but it became a way to exorcise the demons of our past. This account you're reading now is part of that process. But even now, years later, there are moments when the old fears creep back in. Sometimes I wake up in the middle of the night, convinced I'm back in that underground prison. In those moments, I have to remind myself that it's over, that we're safe now. Yet a part of me wonders if we'll ever truly be free. The shelter may have been a physical place, but its walls still exist in our minds. We carry it with us, a secret bunker built of memories and trauma. And sometimes, in my darkest moments, I catch myself checking the locks on the doors, scanning the horizon for mushroom clouds that will never come. Because the most terrifying truth I've learned is this. The real fallout isn't radiation or nuclear winter. It's the lasting impact of a parent's betrayal, the half-life of trauma that continues long after the danger has passed, and that I fear may never fully decay. So if you're reading this, remember, the most dangerous lies aren't always the ones we're told by others. Sometimes they're the ones we tell ourselves to feel safe. Question everything, cherish your freedom, and never take the simple joys of life for granted, because you never know when someone might try to lock them away. And that's the end of the story. I really hope you enjoyed it. Kind of had a deep theme to it, eh? If you liked it, let me know in the comments below if you're on YouTube. If you're on Spotify or anywhere else, so follow for more. I mean, heck, if you're on YouTube, I give you permission to subscribe. You have my full, on God blessed permission. And if you'd like to support this channel even more, there is a Patreon available. I appreciate you if you are a Patreon member. It really means the most. Really helps. And if you'd like to come hang out with the crew, the rest of the gang, come on over to Discord. It's pretty chill, and there are no emergency shelters there. You will not be metaphorically or virtually locked away forever. So I hope you enjoyed yourself here. Thank you for listening. We'll see you in the next one.